You have just tuned in to Thursday Night Talk here on KHSU. This week, Jana Valakovic is our host. As always, we welcome your contributions. Give us a call at 826-4805 at 1-800-640-5911 if you're out of the area, and to our text message line at 492-KHSU. Now over to Jana.
Thank you, Michael. Good evening, and welcome to Thursday Night Talk. I'm Jana Valakovic, your host for tonight's show. And for my day job, I work for the University of California in the Cooperative Extension Program in Eureka office. A few weeks ago, I asked the station if we could do a show on the wildfire season, and Lorna Bryant graciously let me have a regular spot for the third Thursday of October for Thursday Night Talk. And little did I know that the October 8th wildfires would occur. But now the timing of this conversation seems very opportune. So for tonight's show, we're going to focus on wildfire and the intersection of wildlands and communities. Before we kick off, I want to acknowledge that this has been a very impactful year for many listening to this show. Whether you had to evacuate or lost homes in the Brookings or Junction City communities, or maybe you had breathing problems from the smoke from these and other wildfires, or you may have had friends or family who were affected in the Redwood Valley or in the Napa, Sonoma, and Sonoma County fires. With a degree of media attention, the heart-wrenching stories are circulating, and most of us have probably had many moments of disbelief that these fires could move so quickly and so many people could be caught in the middle. And maybe some of you, like I do, have memories of the 1991 Oakland Hills fire that I lived through. I want to share that all of us on the show extend our heartfelt sympathies to everyone who's been affected. And as the rains come in today, and pretty heavy tonight, in fact, and hopefully fire season ends, with this show, I hope we can start to reflect on our experiences and observations, can begin to look for answers, and can record some of the lessons learned so that we can all build stronger, more resilient forests and human communities. So for this conversation, I've got some pretty amazing people joining our show tonight. Eric Knapp is a research ecologist with a specialty in fire and fuels. He works for the Forest Service Research Station in Redding, and he will join us by phone. Hugh Scanlon is the CAL FIRE Humboldt Del Norte chief, who works in Fortuna. Among his many talents are his skills in fire behavior analyst, and today he returned from working on the Mendocino and Lake fires. So we've got some fresh perspectives. And Sibel Immett, a planner with Humboldt County Public Works in the Natural Resources Division. She's a member of the Humboldt County Fire Safe Council, and for more than 10 years has been helping local communities better prepare for wildfire. So we've got three really amazing people. So welcome, the three of you. Thank you for joining me on this show and for sharing your experiences and perspectives. We're going to talk for a little bit, and then we'll let the callers know when we'll be opening up the call lines. But before we get started, I'd like to ask if each of you would like to give a bit more introduction about what you do. And Eric, since you're joining us by phone, why don't you kick us off?
Hi, everyone. Jana, thanks for the introduction. I, like she said, I'm a research ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service, and I work on fuels and fire-related issues and have some experience with prescribed fire, but I've been a long-time observer of the outdoors and fire.
Great. And when you say fuels, maybe, could you help our listeners know what fuels mean?
Well, fuels are basically anything that burns.
All right. So the wood, the grass, everything in between probably, right?
Yes.
Yeah, excellent. Hugh Scanlon, what's a fire behavior analyst and what is a unit chief?
Well, a fire behavior analyst is one of the main jobs that we have is to work on large fires and basically provide some preliminary basic fire prediction, where the fire is likely to go, what kind of rates of spread, how fast the fire is going to move, how long the flame lengths are going to be. So, and that really guides us on what we can do to help control the fires along the perimeters where we're encountering it. And it's really to emphasize the firefighter safety aspect of things, to remind the firefighters in the field of the things that they already have been trained on. We're just kind of reminding them, you've been trained in this. Watch out for this, this, and this today because these things might come to bite you, or you've got some really good opportunities because you have favorable conditions in your area. So I've been a fire behavior analyst since 2002. worked fires all over California as well as the western United States. And I also help teach the National Fire Behavior class in Tucson that's taught every other year, and looking forward to teaching that coming up again. That's a great deal of fun. But as the CAL FIRE unit chief, I'm responsible for the fire operations all over the Humboldt-Del Norte unit, which is Humboldt-Del Norte counties and about a quarter of Trinity County. We're responsible for wildland fire protection on the private lands as well as the state-owned lands that have risk of fire. And we also contract and cover BLM lands and tribal lands as well. So we have that responsibility. We're also involved in resource management, which will involve not only timber harvest regulation, but also looking at fuels management and the things that we can do there, working with prescribed fire and working with communities and our cooperators to try to improve the fire situation and survivability in these fire areas.
Great. That sounds like a big set of jobs. Thank you for doing them. And Sibel, what does a county planner do?
Well, I'm sort of a special kind of county planner. I am not in the land use division, so I have been assigned to the Fire Safe Council and for planning projects associated with managing water bond funding and hazard mitigation projects throughout the county. So I grew up in Humboldt County. I grew up in southern Humboldt County, and Yana and I actually went to high school together, and my teenage years, I grew up working with my father on a small forestry company, thinning forests, working for forest improvement programs and fuels reduction projects. So I kind of grew up with a chainsaw in my hand, too, you might say. And then immediately out of high school, I went and worked for the Forest Service fighting fire on a hand crew and then a fire engine, and then worked my way up to a hotshot crew as I was getting my forestry degree at Humboldt State. And then after that, I got my master's degree in community planning and started working for the Humboldt County Planning Department. Was assigned to the Fire Safe Council as one of my many duties, which was one of my favorite projects to work on. I had the pleasure of working with Hugh Scanlon, who is a member of the Fire Safe Council for several years. And it's my role in the Fire Safe Council is really convening a lot of experts who are like Hugh Scanlon and like folks from the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management and local fire departments and local Fire Safe Councils, and creating a space for them all to come together and share their ideas and help us put together what's called the Community Wildfire Protection Plan and then implement that plan and maintain that plan. And so I really tap into all of their experiences and expertise, and then go after grant funding and try to get projects funded, and then make sure that the plan is available to all of our partners so that they can use it to leverage funding and get projects completed, and work on collaborative projects that we'll talk about probably later. But it's a lot of coordinating and bringing together people who are a whole lot smarter and more experienced than I am, but I feel like I'm sort of the convener.
All right. Great. So in the headlines this year, we've heard Chetco Bar, Helena, Island, Tubbs, Redwood Valley, Atlas, Pocket Fire, just to name a few of the fires of the season. So given how much media attention we've had and how much I think our hearts and minds have been tugged to the South, I thought we'd start with the most recent events in the South and then work our way north. And what I'd like to do is conclude with a discussion about the upcoming training and educational opportunities, because I think we've all gotten a pretty harsh wake-up call that, you know, the landscape can be the fuse, but the homes can really be the most burnable part of the of the environment. And you kind of don't think it could happen in an urban environment, but we certainly saw that that's not the case. So, Hugh, maybe you can start by setting the stage and describing the weather conditions for the Mendocino Lake, Sonoma, Napa fires that ignited on Sunday, October 8th.
Certainly. You can't really just look at the weather alone. You kind of need to consider the climatology. And everybody knows in California we've been dealing with a drought that was going on well on 5 years. And we were very fortunate this winter, had a fantastic rainfall in Northern California, and we ended up with a bumper grass crop. So when grass grows in that kind of volume, And then the thing that did happen this summer as well is it stopped raining. And once it stopped raining, that grass started to cure. And we really did not have that much moisture that occurred throughout the summer. So we've got a bumper crop of grass, and it's all cured out. Then the weather immediately prior to this fire, these fires starting off, really dry conditions, low relative humidities. Light fuels like grass are really responsive to the relative humidity in the air. And when the relative humidity is high, the light fuels, the grasses really don't want to burn so much. But once it really starts dropping down into the 20s and the teens and single digits, the grasses really become very receptive to fire and will burn very, very readily. So we've got fuel that's very ready to burn because we've had extended period of dry conditions for several days, followed by high winds that came into the area that were forecast for those evenings. And these winds in their peak were reaching 70 to 80 miles an hour in some of these locations. And so the winds were just howling. So dry grass, dry winds, low relative humidities, and those were the situations that really set up for a fire that should a fire start, it is really going to burn rapidly, and it's going to consume the fuel very quickly, and it's also going to create a very long-range spotting problem with embers being able to travel a very long distance. So while the fire front may be moving, you've got an ember stream that is moving well ahead of the fire front, starting new fires, off of the main fire.
So I remember, I'm a bit of a weather nerd, and I was looking at my NOAA forecast, and sure enough, across the top, there's this big red bar. It says red flag warning. So red flag warnings were issued for the weekend. Really, what does that mean? And I mean, we experienced them here, yet I don't know if we got the same, out of the Eureka Arcata environment. Did we get the same wind event that evening that hit farther south?
We did experience some of that, but not to the degree that they experienced it further south. We did have a fire right on the north end of Blue Lake.
That's right.
The same time frame that these fires were taking off. And so if we had had the same winds that they had had in the south, the Blue Lake fire would have been much more severe than it was. So we had red flag conditions, and that was basically, those are driven by, again, relative humidities being really low, winds, usually moderate to strong winds, and then also lightning can be a factor in that. In this red flag warning, lightning wasn't a factor, but the National Weather Service may call up a red flag warning for that as well when you've got dry conditions and maybe dry lightning coming into an area.
Right. So, I've been thinking a little bit about this idea that we do quite a bit of education around tornado warnings, and then it gets elevated to a tornado watch. But I don't know how much the general public understands what a red flag warning means and whether there should be some level of precaution. And I looked at the FireWise website over this last week and discovered that they're doing a lot more messaging around red flag warnings. I don't know if anyone has had any thought about that. I had a story of someone in the East Bay, and they talked about, those Diablo winds, those experience of that warm, hot condition, and the winds blowing from the east to the west coming in on Sunday. And, those are all indications that if something is to ignite, that it could be pretty bad. Any comment? I don't know if, Eric, you want to jump into this, but any comment about this general awareness around what a red flag warning could mean? And
well, I can tell you what we do locally here, and we have had you've seen the smoky bear signs that show the fire danger.
Right.
Fire danger being high, very high, extreme, moderate, low. And so we set those every day based upon the forecast for the next day. So that is done in cooperation with the National Weather Service. They help us look at these fire danger indexes, the indices, see how they're changing from day to day. And then we look at what that is likely to mean for the fire danger relative to how the fire danger is in our area. So if we're at the very high end of the fire danger, you'll see it say very high or extreme for an area. For other areas, you know, it may only show high, moderate, or low fire danger. For, you know, with the rain coming in, we're going to be down to low fire danger tomorrow. That can change in a matter of a couple of days. And we've also expanded our use of social media as well. We do have a Twitter outreach, and then when we have red flag warnings or fire danger days that are very high or extreme, we do try to get that information out in social media. But it is very hit and miss. Yeah. Not everybody gets that. Not everybody drives past one of those smoky signs, you know, before they go and engage in whatever activity they're doing out there in the wild land, whether it's mowing their lawns in the middle of the day as opposed to doing it in the morning, or these kinds of things, the things that can end up causing an ignition. We really try to emphasize, avoid doing those things that are likely to cause ignitions when we have really serious fire danger conditions.
So, Eric, I'd like to bring you into this conversation a bit on the on sort of two fronts. And I don't know if you want to add anything more to the kind of general fuel conditions that helped promote some of the rapid fire development in the places to the south. And maybe you might want to jump into this this element of speculation that some are saying that climate change influenced these fires. I even heard a whole piece on Democracy Now! Where they stated it was a conspiracy that fire scientists were not sharing more information about this climate change connection. So, Eric, I guess, what is your perspective on both the fuels conditions, and if you want to add anything to what Hugh set the stage with, and maybe where this climate change piece might be intersecting, or whether we have evidence for that?
Okay, yeah, I'll give it a shot. While I was a grad student at UC Davis, I did a lot of tromping around these landscapes, and like you said, there's a lot of grass and savanna, Oakland savannas there. There's also chaparral shrubs, manzanita, ceanothus, chamise, oaks, some conifers, and all the shrubby vegetation. It tends to burn hot under extreme weather conditions. And like Hugh says, the grasses are fine, flashy fuel and can spread, fire in them can spread really fast in a wind. And in another part of the fuel condition is at least areas that have some woody vegetation hadn't burned in some time, considerable part of it. So there's also the component of the dead fuels that have accumulated over time. And Hugh mentioned the big winter we had and the effect that had on grasses. But one of the points that I see raised less in the media was the effect of the drought. We know the drought was over, but I still think it played some role. And in my wanderings, what I've noticed is that a lot of these shrubs started to look pretty scrappy over time. A lot of dead branches and the oaks, too. And all this dry biomass is pretty combustible. And in comparison, the live shrubs are typically nearly half water at this time of year. So, and then all this fuel was pretty primed to burn because we just haven't had the rain yet. And so then about, what role climate change might have played in this. And there's obviously a lot of speculation about this discussion in the media. There's talk about longer fire seasons and hotter temperatures increasing fire activity and making fires more intense. But I think this lengthening of the fire season is especially evident in the mountains, and that's because of the reduced snowpack and more of the precip falling as rain. And so, yeah, when the snow melts earlier, the fuels dry out earlier, but obviously that's less applicable in these low elevation areas that we don't have a snowpack. But and then, we this drought we went through, it potentially has some links to climate change. It's hard to tell for sure. Obviously, to the extent that this dead vegetation was due to the drought, that could be one link. But we just went through one of the hottest summers on record. So it's possible that climate change could have contributed, to the extent this drought and the hot summer were climate change related. But it's hard to tell for individual events, how much of climate change factors in. But that all said, I think that I don't think that climate change was really a major driver for this particular fire. As Hugh said, this fire had a lot to do with wind. And mm-hmm. if you have high winds and dry fuels, that's really all the ingredients you need for extreme fire behavior. And you know, climate change really isn't necessary to explain what went on out there.
All right, we'll have to let Democracy now know that we're not hiding anything here. But if you're just joining us, you're listening to Thursday Night Talk. I'm Jana Valakovic, your host, and we're talking about wildfire and community preparedness. My guests are Hugh Scanlon, Humboldt Del Norte CAL FIRE Chief, Sibel Emmett, Humboldt County Public Works and the Fire Safe Council, and Eric Knapp, a fire ecologist with the Forest Service. So in thinking about these fires, I've heard some say that defensible space did not matter. And I've heard some people feeling kind of defeated about maybe the preparedness they went through, or trying to understand, did our building codes let us down? You know, what accounted for? I mean, you know, the numbers are staggering right now with these combined set of events of over 5,000 buildings and homes and businesses being lost. And so I guess the question is, do you agree that defensible space didn't matter? And I guess maybe before we take that question, we should walk through how many of the homes and businesses likely burned. Hugh, could you help us understand what a firestorm is like and what a weather-driven ember shower maybe looks and feels like?
Sure, I'll do my best. Generally speaking, you know, not all fires are created equal, and it all depends on the fuel, weather conditions, and just how that fire is moving through that particular environment. And you start to get into conditions where the fire behavior becomes very strong, where you get a great deal of heat being released all at once. You get winds that start moving the fire much faster than the flaming front is moving. And what ends up happening is the embers from the fire itself end up getting lofted ahead of the flaming front and start that whole area in front of the fire and get that burning. Then that lofts additional embers and moves that. And what ends up happening is the entire area that you were in didn't have fire in it. Then you start seeing all these embers coming into your area. And then the next thing is, not only is the area you're in on, and you're trying to leave, on fire, but the area you're going into is catching on fire as you're trying to escape these areas. And sometimes you can move, you know, most of the time we can move faster than the fire is moving. But you get these kinds of winds events, many times you cannot move as fast as that fire is moving through the area. And that's when these fires are especially dangerous. Oakland Hills, the great loss of life in the Oakland Hills fire was largely due to the inability to evacuate safely on that road system that was out there. People were trapped in their cars. These fires happened in the middle of the night when most people were at home sleeping. And you really need to think about what happens with our notification system. How does 911 work? How do we get the information to the people in a community that your community's on fire and you need to get the heck out? In this particular case, not only did we have the 911 system fail in the fire itself, so the ability to contact people, their phones were down. You know, and really, the ability to make people know what was going on was a door-to-door, you know, with law enforcement trying to let people know what was going on. It was a very, very challenging situation out there. And so, much as you hear in battle, there's the fog of war, and, you know, you're never really sure exactly what's going on. When you get into a firestorm situation, it's very much like that. It is hard to know where the fire is, where, you know, you have a pretty good idea where it's going, but you don't know how far it's moved out ahead of you. There are a lot of things, a lot of factors that come into play there that make these very dangerous.
So coming back to the ember piece, I mean, what was particularly unique about the embers? It was igniting the vegetation, so the grasslands. It was igniting the piles of leaves, you know, adjacent to a house. Was there anything else about those embers that are worth noting, like, especially how did it blow across the freeway and get into a McDonald's and into a...
Right. Okay. So with the embers themselves, in order to get embers to move, you really need wind. If you've got a fire that's burning and there's not very much wind, the embers don't go anywhere. And we call that, you know, either no spotting or very short range spotting. The fire just moves a little bit, primarily by the flaming front. You add a little bit of wind to that, you'll get short-range spotting, where the fire, these embers, these are pieces of burning fuel that get lofted up in the smoke column, And before they burn out, they land another receptive fuel ahead and then start another fire. Well, when you get these high winds, many things happen. First of all, the fuel that is burning is not just small material. It gets to be larger material. And with the winds, larger material can get lofted into the column. So bigger stuff gets carried into the smoke column. In addition, the wind will move that larger material a much further distance. It'll move small material a very far distance. For a standard fire, we may see spotting distances of quarter mile to a half mile, which seems like a long ways. In a fire like this, you would see spotting distances that would exceed 3 and 4 miles. Wow. Just from single embers. So the amount of material that moves is substantial. So, and then we'll talk about, you got these moving into the area, and these embers, what do? Is they look for, they land, and they land in receptive fuel. One of the things that they can land in is they can land into a wood pile next to a house. They can get caught in the vents of a house. They can get drawn into the air conditioning systems. We're speculating that a number of the large businesses that were destroyed in Santa Rosa area, they actually had the ember storm being sucked into their HVAC systems, and those buildings were burning from the inside out. And so the fire was getting inside and starting in there. So, yeah, understanding what the embers do, the embers are really one of the key things you need to be able to protect your structure from to keep it from burning. The defensible space makes it so that when embers come in and land next to your house, they really don't have anything to catch on. There's not that much there to burn. But, understanding what the embers, and how to manage that ember storm as it's coming into your residence or your business, that's really the key to surviving one of these events.
I bet some people had their windows open since it was evening and warm, and lots of easy ways to get those embers in. And inside the house, it's perfectly dry and conditioned to ignite, and that becomes the fuel, perhaps.
That's correct. And you had no time to evacuate.
Right.
You found out it was on fire because your neighbor came by knocking on the door, or somebody came by and you looked out the window, and it is time to go.
Right. And then at some point, it probably became a house-to-house kind of more typical urban fire once enough of those homes from the wildland began to catch on fire.
Right. When you started getting into the denser urban setting down around Santa Rosa, that was very likely how that fire was moving, was house to house.
Right.
Because there wasn't a lot of vegetation in that area. It was primarily the structures.
Right. So how common are these kind of significantly weather-driven events?
You want to take that one, Eric?
I would say that, just looking at the statistics in the history of fires in California, the most destructive wildfires tend to be in October in California. So this is a very vulnerable time for us, before the grasses have greened up. But when we're starting to get some winds from storms passing to the north. And so it's something that a combination of factors that happens just about every year. It's just not every year do you have the dry fuels in combination with a windstorm like that.
Yeah, well, I just was working in Lake County, and in the last 3 years, they have had the three largest fires for structure loss in Lake County. We had the sulfur fire this year, 130 homes destroyed, 166 buildings in total. Last year, they had the Clayton fire just outside Lower Lake. And then the year before that, they had the Valley fire, which was the largest structural loss in Lake County, at least in the recorded history. And so, it's one of those things that you kind of look in the short term and you say, wow, well, is this going to be the new normal? Is this the pattern now? We used to go to Southern California for Santa Ana events, seemed like every year, every other year. We really haven't had much going on with Southern California Santa Ana fires for about the last 10 years.
Right.
It's not that they don't happen. Mm-hmm. It's just they're not happening in the magnitude that we saw with the Cedar fire and the other fires that they had in 2003 and the subsequent years into 2008.
Right. I was reflecting last weekend as the week started to calm down, how much material had come down from the previous weekend's windstorms. So, you know, the leaf drop had begun to happen. Mm-hmm. I live under a redwood tree. I had a very large volume of leaf material that had come down. And so I'm sure that also contributed to having lots of receptive fuel close to those homes. So if you're just joining us, this is Thursday Night Talk. I'm Jana Valakovic, your host. We're talking about wildfire and community preparedness. My guests are Hugh Scanlon, Humboldt Del Norte CAL FIRE Chief, Sabelle Emmett, Humboldt County Public Works, and Eric Knapp, a fire ecologist with the Forest Service. We welcome your calls at 826-4805 or 1-800-640-591, or you can text us to 707-492-KHSU. I'd like to get back to that question I threw earlier, and it's, I think, for all three of you guys. So this concept of defensible space, and maybe we can define what that means. When and where does that matter? I mean, here's a case where everything got overwhelmed. So how do we think about that now?
Well, I can tell you what I was looking at as I'm going through the area, and I've worked in fire planning for many years, and I'm one of those folks that I think that when we choose to live in the wild land, we also choose sometimes to take greater risks than you expect when you decide to live in an urban environment. But defensible space is a very important factor for the success in defending your home. Again, all fires are not created equal. We would say that the fires that we had over from October 8th, those are definitely a 99th percentile event. That's one of those events that's, you don't have it happen very often. And when it does, it's terrible. But for the vast majority of the fires that we see, defensible space is by far the difference between whether a structure survives or doesn't survive the fire. It's the difference between whether firefighters can actually be at that residence and defend that structure if you've got resources mm-hmm. available to do that. Even in a firestorm like this, defensible space can be the difference between whether those embers are coming up and getting up to your house with active fire or whether it's just blowing past your house. So defensible space is important.
Right.
It's all part of a whole package that everybody needs to be aware of, along with making sure that those embers can't find a place to ignite on your home or around your home, the defensible space, the preparedness for evacuating at the drop of a hat, or if you have enough time to do a few things around your house, like move that broom or move that doormat that might be flammable. It's all about just knowing what to do within the whole package of your home and your homestead and your driveway, and if you've taken all of the various steps, then you're ready for whatever kind of fire phenomenon might be facing your community.
Great. Eric, do you have anything you want to add on to this?
Well, I think that covers it pretty well. I mean, I think one thing that made it was a good reminder, I think, for these fires, that defensible space is just one component of making your house fireproof. You know, you still have to do the other things, and maybe that needs to become more of the community discussion, you know, beyond defensible space. Cleaning out your gutters, covering attic vents in when you have a red flag warning or just doing other things like that. So I think it's not well understood how houses are lost. We see pictures on TV of massive flames, you know, fronts of flame, and assume that, you know, it's just direct flame impingement on a house that causes the loss. But I don't think we often think about embers being the cause of loss, but doing what we can to avoid embers getting into your house, I think, is really important.
Right, right. And then one of the challenges is that your own vulnerability is probably somewhat dependent upon your neighbor's condition. If your house mm-hmm. is close enough, and if your neighbor hasn't prepared well enough and your house is close enough, their environment may affect your environment. And I know earlier I threw out a term called house to house, which gets at the concept that, you know, there's so much heat coming out of the house that's burning that it will cause adjacent combustible material to combust, and you get an event where one house is combusting the next house and sequentially. Right. And I think that's what that coffee park community experienced to some degree.
Yeah, there's also the consideration that if you have good defensible space and you have a home fire, that your home fire is not going to spread into the wildlands and spread into your neighbor's yards.
Right, right. And then there's defendable space too, mm-hmm. right?
Safety for firefighters.
That someone will come, mm-hmm. yeah. Yep. Well, I know we've got a caller, and I just want to sort of use this as, I think, a good time to pivot with this call. I think what we'll want to do is shift to some of the other fires that we've experienced in our listener range. But first, we'll take our call, and I think we have George from Hawkins Bar. Welcome to Thursday Night Talk.
Well, good evening. First of all, I want to really thank you for the topical conversation this evening, and really enjoying the show. Dim down everything else so we can listen. We're out here, you know, they're kind of the rural wild interface, and I can really appreciate the stress folks are under in that urban rural interface.
Yeah.
Down in Santa Rosa, my mother, in fact, has returned home after being displaced for a week, and she went to my sister's in Portland. But a couple of questions. You know, I know we have to take precautions and create our defensible space, and there's an enormous budget I can appreciate, federal and state, that combines nationally here to combat these wildfires. We receive statements from California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection through the Equalization Board each year out here in Hawkins Bar, collecting about $150, $160 per property as a fire assessment. And I was just curious, what do we do in that regard in some of these more rural-urban interface areas? I wonder how that fee is distributed equally, and maybe this isn't the right panel for that conversation, but perhaps some of your folks know about this.
Well, yeah, this is Hugh, and I can talk a little bit about the SRA fee. And actually, the SRA fee...
Can you define SRA first?
That's state responsibility area. So those are the private lands that are at risk of wildland fire outside incorporated cities, largely. And that fee is $150. It's gone up a little bit over the last few years. But that fee was assessed for fire prevention. And that has gone to support not only the fire prevention mission of the department, but also to help communities, fire safe councils with grants. There are a number of different things that have been done with that money. That fee was suspended in July of 2017. So that fee is no longer being collected for 2017, and I believe that's suspended into the indefinite future. So they're recognizing that other funding sources through cap and trade are important when it comes to the fire mission and fire prevention as well. And so the funding source has shifted to that, and that just happened this year.
Okay. Yeah. Well, at least we're trying to look at these issues in a more holistic way. Let's transition to the Chetco Bar and the Helena fires. Chetco Bar burned almost 200,000 acres. Fewer homes and buildings have been lost, I think somewhere around 10. And then there's the Helena fire, which I know I was fortunate to see in the last week. It's visible on 299. It's about 20,000 acres, but many more homes and a whole community was largely extinguished. So maybe it's a question for Eric. I don't know. Maybe it's Hugh. How can you interpret the factors that influence each of those more wildland-related fires and what we're experiencing from them?
Well, this is Eric, and I could say a little bit more about the Helena fire since that's a little bit in our backyard, and I live at Redding. For the heck of it, pulled up the weather conditions immediately prior to and during the Helena fire, and you can pretty readily see some similar themes emerge there that occurred in the fires in the North Bay. The Helena fire started on the 30th of August, and like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and the 30th was preceded by some really hot days. I think the 28th got up to 110. humidities down into the single digits, 6 to 9% relative humidities. So that meant the fuel's pretty baked and dry. I mean, there was just dry as could be. And as friends have told me that the Trinity River corridor, it gets these up canyon winds, so it's a little bit of a wind funnel. And sure enough, when you looked at the winds on the day that it started, they had the strongest winds of the week. They tend to peak right in the mid to late afternoon between 3 and 5 p.m., so right about the time it started. That day they were blowing at 20 miles per hour upriver. So, yeah, I think the wind and dry fuels, it's a common factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chetco Bar Fire, that started as part of the lightning that had come through. We actually had a pretty active lightning season this year. Six Rivers, Klamath got hit pretty hard, as well as the Rogue Siskiyou. And they were chasing quite a few lightning fires. And when you get lightning fires that are occurring in some of these really remote areas, the approach that's being taken to working with those fires, you know, if they're not really putting communities at risk, and there's a good chance that fire may go out on its own, what they'll do is they'll look at a strategy where they call it confinement, where they'll look at where can we keep this fire kind of up in this area so it really doesn't go anywhere where it's going to do any damage to anything. And while it's a fantastic system when it works, we actually had a very similar set of wind conditions occur in southwestern Oregon. Extremely dry air, strong winds out of the northeast blowing southwest, basically took this fire that was not doing a great deal up there in the mountains and just made a huge push out toward the coast. And that's what really put the risk on Brookings and threatened that area. And that did result in a major response. It resulted in a response even down here in California, where we ended up being prepared for should that fire come across the state line, that we actually had fire lines in place ready to work from. So, yeah, that was a fire that had a great deal of concern. And I think the really important point to everybody is you look at these coastal areas and you go, my gosh, this is coastal Northern California, coastal Southern Oregon. You know, these fires don't occur here. The answer is yes, they do. Mm-hmm. They do occur here. They have a pattern to them. You can look at fire history for an area, and you can see these fires, most cases, will burn from the northeast corner to the southwest corner until they finally go out. And that's very, very common for these fires here. That's what these fires were doing down in the North mm-hmm. Bay as well. So it's very common to see that weather pattern set up with the strong winds. You don't think these fires happen here, but they do. They're just not extremely common. There was a fire in the Santa Rosa area that was very similar to the same footprint that occurred in 1964.
That's right. Right. So a lot of wildland fire this year. I mean, the Marble Mountains as well. What's the overall, I don't know, what shall we call it, intensity, severity of these fires? Are they doing good things? Are they stand-replacing types of fire?
We would call them a mixed severity fire. Mm-hmm.
Like a weasel word.
It sounds like a weasel word, but it isn't. It's an area where a lot of the area is low severity, where you just have the fire kind of burning through the understory. You get other places where you get high severity. They're pretty small pockets. They're not usually a huge area of what you would consider, the burned, treeless stand of nothing but burnt sticks. You don't see a lot of that where, you had a crown fire and total stand replacement. And then you'll have some areas where it's kind of burned in between. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, these...
A mosaic
effect. And that's very accurate. Down in Lake County on the Sulphur Fire above Clear Lake, the fire effects themselves on the ground due to the winds and the rapidity with which the fire went through the area was actually relatively low intensity to moderate intensity in the wildlands.
Right.
You know, a lot of the timber that was in that area is going to survive.
Right.
It's just when it got into the structures burned with pretty high severity. So, you know, with a lot of intensity there. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, as it moved through the wildland itself, it wasn't particularly destructive in terms of ecological effects.
All right. Eric, do you have a perspective on those Marble Mountain fires at all, or the Klamath Mountain fires, in terms of severity?
Yeah, I think with the heavy winter we had, I think our expectation going into the fire season was that we would see fires that burned at lower than average intensity and caused, you know, less than severe effects. And, you know, to some extent that happened, but then there were some mitigating factors, you know, the hottest summer on record, and then those wind patterns that he was talking about. There's occasional wind events where the fire got up and ran, or the various fires. But overall, I just took a look at the latest satellite images of these fires, and what the agencies do is compare basically the chlorophyll, the green in images pre-fire and post-fire, to look at how it changed the vegetation. And in a lot of these fires, they still show, you know, more than 70% of the area burned at low to moderate severity effects, meaning that there's still some forest there in the forested areas. And despite some of these large high severity runs, I think there's a lot of what I call good fire also occurred. Hmm. Just a fire with a characteristic mix of severities.
Hmm. Right. So one of the big impacts that a lot of communities faced, and I think some on the coast were particularly taken aback by this, was these weeks of smoky air quality and ash. Mm-hmm. Is this kind of our new normal?
That's an interesting question. If you look at when the European explorers were sailing up and down the coast of California, they considered it to be an extremely smoky area, you know, and this was in the, you know, 1500s, 1600s. Smoke is nothing new to the California landscape. The indigenous peoples have been using fire in California for thousands and thousands of years. And, you know, then there was no real effective control back in those days at all. So, you know, fire was a very common component of these ecosystems. And when you consider the acreage that was considered to have burned during the course of a year back then, it's much, much, much greater acreage than burns now.
Right.
So one can only presume that the smoky conditions that we see here are probably not anomalous. They probably were very common.
Right, right. I can see we're getting close to the end of our show here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Thursday Night Talk, and we're talking about wildfire and community preparedness. I've got a couple more questions I want to get through. And I guess what if I'm to sort of summarize it now is, you know, today was the great shakeout, right? And I think some of us maybe were paying attention to earthquake and tsunami preparedness. So what does fire preparedness look like in comparison? And what do, you know, are there any lessons that we can take from what we've just experienced to put ourselves in a better position?
Well, I could touch on that a bit. I think there's a lot of similarities between preparedness for wildfire and earthquake and tsunami and hazardous material issues. I've been thinking about that a lot as we've been reading the news about the great California shakeout. And there's some subtle differences, but I think that what we're messaging about throughout the communities to prepare for wildfire can also be applied to preparing for the earthquake or the tsunami, depending on where you live. So I think it's important for people to do those things like prepare for evacuation and have your emergency supply kit and know where your safe zones are and your escape route is for all of those various disasters. One thing that I've been thinking about related to the wildfire that's a little bit different, in preparation for the earthquake, we have lots of supplies ready for a period of time when we might be isolated. But with wildfire, you have to have your go kit because you have to leave your home. So all those important papers and information that you want to make sure that you have if your house is potentially going to be lost, you want to have that all in one place and be able to grab that and go really quickly. And then what we also promote through the Fire Safe Council, I think a lot of people would consider to be mitigation rather than preparedness. And that's where we're maybe a little bit different than preparing for wildfire because, I mean, preparing for earthquake or something like that, because we want to be prepared for if that fire comes and we're not home, the damage is still going to be reduced because we've mitigated for that damage. And that's the fuels reduction and the way that you've constructed your home so that those embers can't come through your vents or lodge in your gutters and catch on fire. You have to do that all ahead of time, and I can kind of consider that mitigation. Mm-hmm. And that's really important for people to do, because a lot of times you're not going to be home, so you need to make sure that your home is going to be able to survive a fire without you there.
And Sabelle is right on when it comes to you're preparing for an earthquake and you think about the supplies. Well, the supplies actually are really important should you get a large fire in the area as well, because what will often happen is there will be an evacuation set up. Then there will be a period of time after things have sort of cooled down that we can get people back into their residences, but they may not have power. They may not have water. They may still need that set of supplies that they had there, and it's just as applicable. We've got a number of folks now that are back in their residences that they still don't have power.
Right. I think with our communications, too, I think that everyone in Humboldt County should be signing up for the Humboldt Alert system, because you'll get that alert if there's a wildfire coming your way, if there's an earthquake, if there's any other kind of natural disaster. You want to be signing up for Humboldt Alert. So you want to just Google Humboldt Alert, sign up. It can be a little bit of a long process, answer a few questions, but just do it and get it done. And then maybe when we have the disaster, people will get a little bit more notice than they did in other areas. But you have to opt in to that program.
Right. I did a little looking around today. Del Norte has an equivalent one. So there's Del Norte alerts for those in the Del Norte listening area. And I know there's something similar for Mendocino. I didn't look for Trinity County, but we need to get better at being, you know, as we transition out of these into cell phones instead of home-based phones and all of the ways that we communicate.
Yeah, most of the counties have some sort of system set up. Mostly in the South, they're using Nixle for notifications. And, you know, there are all kinds of systems out there.
Yeah, I signed up for Nixle. It was really simple. All I had to do was put in my zip code and my phone number. So, but I think we want to promote what's really being used here right now. Yeah. So I understand there's some educational programs coming up. Sabelle, maybe you can share what the county and the Fire Safe Council are planning?
Yes. So the Humboldt County Fire Safe Council is in the process of providing guidance to the update of our Humboldt County Community Wildfire Protection Plan. And as part of that process, we have in the past gone out to communities and we share information about wildfire preparedness, and then we also collect information from local knowledge about what people's concerns are, where they would like to see more fuels reduction work, where there are good water sources for firefighting. So it's a give and take kind of a workshop environment. We provide information. We often have CAL FIRE available. We're hoping to have OES, Office of Emergency Services, participating. Often there's local fire district personnel involved in these workshops. And we are going to be having 14 of these workshops starting in Neyland on October 26th. That's next Thursday from 6 to 8 at the Neyland Elementary School. And you can go to the Humboldt County Fire Safe Council website. Just Google Humboldt County Fire Safe Council. And we'll probably be providing some links on this website also. And you'll be able to get the whole list of community workshops. But we'll be having workshops in the Mid-Klamath area, in the Orleans, Redwood Park, Avenue of the Giants, Willow Creek, Southern Humboldt, West Haven, Trinidad area, Redwood Creek, Titlow Hill area, Humboldt Bay region, Lower Eel, Van Dusen River, sort of in the Bridgeville area. Lower Mattole Watershed, Mad Van Dusen River, the Upper Yurok Reservation, the Humboldt County portion of the Yurok Reservation, and the Hoopa Valley. So if you live near any of those communities, we encourage you to participate in one of those workshops, because we want to share more detailed information with you about how to prepare, and then we also just want to hear from you. It's a collaborative process, and in the past, community input has been incorporated into the plan, and it's really helped us prioritize where we want to put our energy into trying to bring in funding to support various programs. CAL FIRE planning folks use the fire plan for kind of connecting when they have some funding through, say, like the SRA fee to do fuels reduction work. We have already had communities identify these projects. You know, you have support for it in the community, sort of connecting resources where people have already identified projects.
I can imagine that there's also a place where people can come and get answers to their questions.
Yes. People can definitely get answers to their questions.
Excellent. I also know there's a workshop October 24th, next Tuesday, from 3 to 8, called After the Fire, which is going to be held in Brookings at the Southwestern Community College Curry campus. And this is for small woodland owners and a local community trying to think about rebuilding and what that whole restoration process might need to look like. I know I'm in the education circles, and I have been hearing lots of other events in the works now for Mendocino communities, and so I think there's going to be a lot of push out this year for folks to get some more information and think about this.
Yeah, the Cal Fire site on the website also has a great deal of information just in getting ready for a wildfire or what happens after you've been in a wildfire and being able to return and to your residence and to be ready for that. And so there's that document. Sabelle's talked about the Living with Wildfire at Northwestern California. It's a good publication, has a lot of information. There is a lot of information out there. Question of just going out and searching for it. It doesn't just jump out at you sometimes.
Yeah, and if we've wet any of the listeners' whistles today with tonight's show, there are a number of resources I posted on the KHSU webpage for kind of more information and places for people to move on with these topics. As I conclude, and as we're listening to Thursday Night Talk, I'd like to end with one last question, and if we could do a quick go around on it. Maybe, Eric, I'll start with you. What are your concluding thoughts about forest and community resilience? What do we need to do?
Well, I think events like this are great. Public education, making people realize there's multiple components to fire preparedness, and learning that fire is part of our landscape, like earthquakes. Like hurricanes in the southeast, and we have to think about it in that way.
Yeah, from the Cal Fire perspective, we're really looking at communities, what communities can do, what we can do to help communities be better prepared for wildfire. I really want to emphasize the importance of your local volunteer fire departments. They are a key part of the defense in these areas. We use them a lot. We're using them now. To help us through this tough time. And your local fire department needs your help. If you're an able-bodied and want to be a part of that, they could use your help or they can use your support. And then we're also emphasizing a return of the use of prescribed fire, really focusing on getting the right fire in the right place at the right time when we have the control over it so that we can get these areas treated and they become less susceptible to wildfire.
Mm. Great.
So, crazy wind-driven fires aside, I look forward to the time when Humboldt County residents have done all that they can do to prepare for wildfires so that we can let natural fire regimes return to this area and people can still feel safe that we can have prescribed fire amongst our communities, between our communities, and people can feel safe. And I'm just want to just hold that vision in my head that we can reach a point where everybody has done what they can do on their own and then working together and to support our local volunteer fire departments and live safely in a wildfire environment.
Mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about when the forests are healthy, the community's healthy. Mm-hmm. And when the community is healthy, the forests are healthy. Mm-hmm. And it goes sort of both ways. We can't escape the world we live in. We can build and armor ourselves through lots of different means, but we have to work together in all of this. I want to thank all of the three of you for your amazing leadership on these challenging issues. I know a lot of you have taken a lot of media calls over the last couple of days, and I appreciate you being available to share your perspectives. Again, we've posted some information on the Thursday Night Talk webpage, so if you want to follow up with some more ideas, you're welcome to go there. And I'd like to thank Eric Knapp, fire ecologist with the Forest Service, Hugh Scanlon, Humboldt Del Norte Fire Chief, and Sabelle Emmett, Humboldt County Public Works, and with the Fire Safe Council. And I'd like to thank George, and I know we've got a couple of calls we didn't quite get to, but we'll try and take those off air. And I'd like to thank the listeners for listening. And again, we send our sympathies to anyone who's been impacted by these fires. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Thursday Night Talk here on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Jana Valakovic, and our guests this evening. We love to get feedback on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org and like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Coming up next week on Thursday Night Talk, most Americans now fear a nuclear war more than ever. Did watching the 10-part documentary on the Vietnam conflict help or worsen these fears? On the next Thursday Night Talk, join host Brenda Starr and guests when they discuss war, peace, and refugees. Your calls are welcome. October 26th, beginning at 7. Thanks to KHSU Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme